We've got soldiers that are training right there, and to ensure their safety, they're going to be moved from Fort Magsaysay, that's near Manila, into Manila, into a hard stand or into a more protective site.
3, 2, 1. When it comes to regulating the library, borough assembly members are trying to walk a fine line. On one hand, they don't want to restrict access to ideas. On the other hand, they want to avoid upsetting people who want to protect their children from controversial subjects. Assemblywoman Karen Parr says members find themselves in a difficult situation.
A lot of the people who homeschool their children or who send their children to a Christian school utilize the library heavily. And even though I don't agree with their viewpoint, I think we should consider it in looking at the displays of that front showcase.
Problem is, lawyers have advised policymakers that if they make the display case open to one group, it must be open to all. So to protect the sensitivities of some, assembly members say they may have to limit the case to displays generated only by library staff. But rather than vote Thursday, members decided to wait. They'll work on the issue again next week and perhaps consider an alternative when the assembly meets again in 2 weeks. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
It's more a matter of trying to move to the center a little bit and compromise and say, well, where children are involved, let's just be a little more discreet about some things.
In conjunction with that observance, I'm going to propose a resolution to the Tanana Valley Conference of Churches that we express a caring welcome for gay and lesbian persons, and that we repudiate all words and acts of hatred towards such persons.
From the beginning, designers of the library's gay and lesbian history display say they only wanted to educate the public about the gifts given and the threats borne by homosexuals. It was meant to be a low-key presentation, but the controversy that swirled around it continues. After stirring weeks of discussion in the local newspaper, the debate is now before the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. At Thursday's meeting, members will take up a proposal that aims to bar the library from mounting displays containing sexually oriented themes in its public display cases. Assemblyman Bob Logan says he wants the library to be more discreet when airing controversial subjects.
We really don't want to see the library be a citadel of controversy. That's kind of the borough assembly's, not job, but that's the position they find themselves in, is hashing out these things at the borough assembly building. You go to the library to read.
Logan suggests the next time such a display is proposed, library directors place it in a back room out of view of children. Library officials, though, say the ordinance is poorly worded and so vague that it would be difficult to enforce. But as government officials address the argument, area churches are also taking up the issue. While some parishes condemn homosexuality, others are using the display to reconsider their church's role. Fairbanks Lutheran Church pastor Richard Krager says he'll ask the Tanana Valley Conference of Churches to specifically welcome gays and lesbians. Krager says he decided to take a stand after hearing many people quote the Bible in what he says was hateful condemnation of the display.
They certainly don't speak on my behalf, and they don't speak what I would want to say or what I understand to be the position of our Lord Jesus Christ. And so we want to speak out at this time and take a stand that gay and lesbian persons are welcome in our churches.
Krager says the conference represents many of the area's largest congregations. He'll take his proposal to the leadership Thursday night, about the same time the borough assembly will be considering Logan's measure. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
A while before Desert Shield started up, President Bush at the time mentioned how the resources of Saudi Arabia and the Middle East were very hard to keep stable, and how we should become more reliant upon United States oil and resources. Right now, in spite of the statehood compact, we have you and the two senators dunning the president to open ANWR at a 50-50 split for Alaskans. I think that that's a shameful act, and I think that you should cease and desist and explain to the Congress, if they haven't already learned from history, that we cannot keep running to the Middle East every time some potentate has a problem. We need to develop Alaskan oil or other American finds now, without worrying about foreign entanglements and other reasons that we'd have to go into foreign spaces with American troops to die for somebody else's oil. We need to develop Alaskan oil now, and we don't need to sell Alaskans out of the statehood compact in the name of giving us, quote, 50% of nothing, or something is better than 90% of nothing. Alaskan oil is going to be important to the United States, and I think they ought to learn right now from somebody like yourself who has enough experience to know who to tell. What do you feel
I appreciate your comments, and you know, I understand your frustration, because just something I've been saying for years. Realistically, I know that, you know, we could not get 90-10 passed here, and I do think it breaks the compact, and I do frankly think there will be people go to court over it and eventually win this this issue and this argument. And I've said that up front. And I've talked to people, and, you know, whether we like it or not, one of the things that hurts us the most is that we have made a considerable amount of money off of Prudhoe Bay, and every time they read in the paper, you get $990 from a dividend check. They say, you got a surplus, why should we let you have anything? And they say, it's federal land. And I say, well, you're breaking the Constitution. I've talked to Jack Coghill on this. I talked to Walla Hickel on this, broken promises. That's why Joe Vogler and the rest of the state had the strong secession movement, the independent group. And, you know, I've got every sympathy in the world. It's just going to take a lot of effort to bring to light the injustice that's occurring. And my decision has been all along that, well, right, we'll take the 50-50, and then we'll go after the rest of it at a later time. If necessary, we'll do it through the court system. But there will be a way that we get our just dues, or, frankly, the compact is no longer valid. The rest of the states got a good breakthrough reclamation. We did not get any reclamation monies. Every other state's got tremendous reclamation dollars. We did not. But the reality is, the image of Alaska down here is, and I don't hope you had a chance to read that Jessica Lange, I think, it wrote the article on Alaskan's greed. It was in a syndicated column, and you ought to read it. You and I are bad people. We're bad because we believe in states' rights. We're bad because we happen to have some resources. And it's really a scathing type definition of Alaskans, and that's printed nationwide, and it makes it very difficult to do business down here.
Caller, I do have to let you go. We've got... When the state gave the University of Alaska the right to harvest timber at Cape Yakutaga, it sparked a complex battle of interests. Environmentalists and fishermen, Fish and Game and the Division of Forestry, the City of Yakutat, as well as the University and the Division of Natural Resources, all had issues about logging the land. With such a group, any agreement might be lucky, but the way this one worked out, even the concessions looked good. From harvest revenues, the university will put $250,000 into forestry and environmental research in the area. It will also fund $500,000 ecotourism pilot project there, a cabin and trail hiking system. Statewide Land Management Director Martin Epstein says the project may benefit the university beyond Cape Yakutaga.
We are a diversified operation in that we have interests in several hundred thousand acres of land, including this timber. And have looked to tourism as a means to generate income for the university, and we're hopeful that this will be a success operationally as well as financially, and possibly could lead to other similar types of ventures by the university or others in the state.
Steve Kallick worked for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council during the negotiations. He said Yakutaga is a good pilot project, even though it's remote and stormy.
We're actually hopeful that systems like this will be built in other forest areas, because especially in the coastal forest, it's a good way for people to see the country in a comfortable way.
A feasibility study for the project will be underway this year. The university has just a one-cut harvest right to land around Cape Yakutaga. In the coming legislative session, it will ask to be given the land outright. Martin Epstein.
I think the benefit to ownership would be in the future, when regeneration starts to take place, we'll have the opportunity to, if it's to look at opportunities such as pre-commercial thinning to improve the health of the stand that's
let the first of several logging contracts in the next couple of weeks, expecting to gain in excess of $10 million from the cut over 4 years' time. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. QVC came to Alaska as part of a scheme to showcase what it called the best 20 products from each of the 50 states. The cable station boasts over 50 million viewers, and in last June's broadcast, it showed them and sold them 24,000 Alaskan items, bringing in over $700,000 for QVC and for the vendors. Fairbanks jewelry designer Pat Perlman was chosen to display her work that day. She sold 800 pins worth over $36,000 in just 3 minutes. Since then, she's gone back on QVC. In September, she sold out her wares in 8 minutes, and she anticipates doing more with the channel in the future.
We're certainly pursuing it and hoping that it will grow into something because it's a tremendous potential. I've been always looking for something to make a business more year-round because Alaska is mostly summer business. And this would do it, you know, and so far so good.
QVC isn't the only electronic opportunity. Pat Perlman designs can also be found on storefront web pages on the Internet. This addition to traditional sales, jewelry sold in stores, through mailing lists, catalogs, and by sales representatives, exposes a small business owner to an emerging global market. Bill Pollack works with the State Division of Trade and Development in Juneau. Like Perlman, he believes the Internet can help many Alaskan businesses find larger markets.
Matter of fact, I had the opportunity to sign on to Internet and sign on and see Alaska's first sales net, I think it was in Nome, and they were selling Alaska native-made art and masks and such. It was phenomenal, beautiful web page and beautiful pieces of artwork. I think that that is the marketing venue of the future, yes.
Pollack says he thinks Alaska's economy will always be built on a foundation of natural resources.
But in terms of getting jobs for your children, my children, we're going to have to find ways to add value and quit exporting our resources in the wholesale mode. We're going to have to get into the retail mode. This particular electronic format allows us to do that and compete no matter whether you're in Kotzebue or Juneau or Anchorage or Fairbanks or any other spot in the state.
In 25 years designing and making jewelry in Fairbanks, Pat Perlman has counted mostly on the summer tourist season and Christmas trade. In the past 5 or 6 years, business has been good and growing. A growth the Internet and opportunities like QVC can't help but help.
I kind of had this idea when I got started of making art for the masses, and it feels like it's being actualized in this sort of thing, because here I am, you know, in front of the masses. So I guess I feel like maybe things are being actualized, you know, so it's dreams that I had.
Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Many of Fairbanks' Jewish community compare the assassination of Rabin to the death of John F. Kennedy. They express wonder and dismay that this kind of assassination could take place in Israel, and many are worrying over the fate of the peace process Rabin set in motion. Larry Kaplan is a member of the town's only synagogue. He wonders if Rabin can even be replaced.
There are other leaders, but he had some special qualities and some special history in that country of being a war hero and managed to, as we have seen, to unite different factions. There's that element, and there's also the element of the existence of a political faction in Israel which is willing to subvert a democratic government by using assassination to accomplish its means.
Leah Schuldiner agrees, and she blames the extreme right-wing activists for the violence. An Israeli who's lived in Fairbanks for 14 years, she says Israelis have always held strong political opinions and have loved to debate. But after the passionate political argument was over, there used to be, she says, an underlying feeling of unity. Now she wonders if that's been lost forever.
It just really came down on me, realizing what, we have a new Israel, and I really felt that way because this is something that never, ever happened in Israel before.
Jerry Berman, another member of Fairbanks' Jewish community, has a wife and child who live in Jerusalem. He says while Rabin's death will polarize the already deeply divided peace process, it won't derail it.
You could almost say, but I wouldn't go that far to say that almost a civil war might be imminent, because some of the settlers in the West Bank have been threatening violence for a while already, and they say if they were to be evacuated or that the rule was given over to Palestinians, that they would resist the Israeli soldiers, which in Israel is unthinkable. But I think on the other hand, it will strengthen Rabin will in a sense become a martyr, I think, and it will strengthen those who are for the peace process.
The local Jewish congregation plans a memorial service this evening at 7 o'clock. Their temple is on Aurora Drive. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
If it's the rest of the land is not part of the national park, national forest, woods and things like that, then why don't we let the people in the state of Alaska, for example, decide how they want to use or not use or lock up or what they want to do with the land that's left over. And I'm very much in favor of that, because I believe we've got to downsize the federal government. And as I said, I mean, you folks up here know how best to preserve the land, and you can make the decisions yourselves. That's what the whole American Revolution is about. They have followed me on every single issue. I mean, the Republican Party, look at it now. Our 1990 campaign, 91-92 campaign, has set the agenda for the Republican Party in the present. So they're all coming our way on the issues. And you watch, when we're here, they will follow me up here. Watch them.
Before this visit, Pat Buchanan had been in Alaska only twice. Both times, the state was a mere stopover on the way to China and Japan. This time, he came delivering a message that he hopes will gain him presidential power.
I feel that our campaign is very much in tune with the values and views of the people of Alaska. They're independent-minded, and what my campaign is all about is basically giving them back, you know, control of their own destiny, their own resources, their own land. Y'all make the decisions up here for Alaska. You don't need folks down in Washington telling you what to do.
Buchanan has served as standard bearer for the conservative voters who have lately dominated the Republican Party. On issues from abortion, immigration, taxation, and states' rights, Buchanan says he's led the way for other more popular candidates to take up the cause. Now, he predicts, those same politicians will follow his lead to Alaska.
We came up here and we hit those five stops. Dole will be up here now. Graham will be up here now, at least. Keys will probably be up here, and I think the very fact that we came first and put a spotlight on the issues of Alaska is the reason they're going to be following up.
Nearly all of Buchanan's competitors have spent the last few days in Maine trying to get the endorsement of voters there who spent Saturday in caucuses. While he barely registered any support in that state, he says this year Alaska's more important. That's because Republicans here will hold their caucus in January, a week before Louisiana, and candidates who show well in the South will have an edge in the presidential election.
I came up here because I think our message resonates here. I think we can do well here. I think a real strong showing up here before Louisiana would have very dramatic impact, whereas I don't think Maine's going to have any impact at all.
Buchanan spent Sunday afternoon touring sites around Fairbanks. He visited the pipeline and took a sled ride with musher Ramey Brooks, saying he was surprised the dogs were smaller than those two huskies living in his own neighborhood. But as many people here already know, Alaska's reality almost always differs from its image, and that, say state Republicans, is exactly why they're courting these tourists. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Our reorganization was an attempt to take a dwindling staff and aim it in certain directions where the workload is, and then if somebody is not available on one team, they can request services from another specialist from another team. So we'll be able to cross all the boundaries. They're not going to be fixed and firm, but everyone will be available to do the work that's at hand.
3, 2, 1. The new Northern District covers roughly half the state, from Unalakleet east to Tok. It was created by combining the old Steis White Mountains, Kobuk, and Arctic districts into one, then by subdividing some 60 million acres of public lands into several smaller units, BLM spokeswoman Sharon Wilson.
We decided that the people who work with the public out on the land are the ones that know best how to get their jobs done, and with the least amount of extra extraneous work that may not be necessary. So we split our three districts up and made 7 geographic units out of them.
Wilson says each unit will have its own team made up of biologists, recreational planners, rangers, and other officials. The change comes as the Fairbanks office has shrunk by about a third in the last few years. The office now hosts about 100 employees. Wilson says the team concept was borrowed from private industry, where it's proven successful for encouraging employees to take responsibility for the success or failure of particular projects. This reorganization was begun more than a year ago, and officials expect some bumps along this latest path, but Wilson says people are starting to make changes.
It's very difficult for people who have worked for the government for a lot of years to suddenly find themselves in a team position and a team position of responsibility, but I can already see a difference in attitudes around here. There, some of the people are grabbing hold and taking issues on and getting into the decision mode.
Wilson says the public should notice few changes, since paperwork and regulations will still be the same. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
There's some question just how many apartments are available for Fairbanks renters. Based on the borough's latest research, this June there were twice the number of apartments available to renters than a year ago, and prices dropped by about 1%. While not so dramatic, the trend seems to extend into September. Mark Gramstad helps compile the figures for the borough.
Every quarter I perform a rental vacancy rate survey, and I contact approximately 100 landlords around the Fairbanks North Star borough and find out how many rental units that they have vacant at that point, both apartments, mobile homes, houses, and cabins. But when I'm looking at the numbers of apartments available, and that's what my vacancy rate is computed on, that jumps from, say, 300 to 500, that's a dramatic rise.
In this case, June's vacancies jumped from 152 last year to 314 this year. But local realtor Randy Smith doesn't see those vacancies or the prices. He says from his vantage point, rents this summer were at a record high and rental homes were snapped up. He says it seems far from a renter's market.
Renters have been finding a shortage of housing, and my perspective of that comes from people walking into my office in a panic frame of mind. This generally only happens in the summer, but people come up here, they have jobs to start, and many people just assume they're going to be able to find homes for their families. And there again, I'm going back to more the 3 and 4 bedroom size home.
Part of the discrepancy is based on differing markets. The borough's figures come from apartment vacancies, and Smith is talking about house rentals. Both Smith and Gramstad point out the seasonal fluctuations in both markets, but even accounting for the flux, the borough's figures indicate more vacancies. Glenn Estabrook is a landlord who says he's noticed the difference. Only 75% of his units are filled.
I've been advertising them for a week, and I'll admit that the response has been lower than usual. I would usually get 20 to 30 calls in a week's time, and I didn't get 10 calls this time. Last year was the best year as a landlord, both on terms of the market pressure, people wanting to rent, and the rents they were willing to pay.
Most managers of larger apartment complexes are reluctant to talk about specifics, but some admit vacancies are up slightly over last year. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
The teams will make the decisions as far as where the money is going to be spent, what projects are going to take priority, what are the results they want to see, and then they also...
I'm recording now. If you tell me your name and title, please.
3-2-3-2-1. 2 months after the borough built reuse platforms at area dumpster sites, officials say they're getting good reviews. Bob Jordan, assistant solid waste manager at the borough, says the current pilot project remains popular with residents and signs point to its expansion.
I just hope that the community or the individuals that use them continue to do so in pretty much the manner as they have been using them in the past month or two. As long as the reuse areas stay fairly presentable and they're not overloaded with items which are obviously not reusable, then I don't see any reason at this point that they would be discontinued.
The borough built platforms in September at dumpster sites at each end of Farmers Loop Road. In October, workers installed another in North Pole, and they're planning one more for the Chena Pump site once it's moved to its new location. Jordan says so far people have made good use of the areas, though he'd like now to see people take big items like refrigerators and stoves directly to the landfill.
Appliances that are left on the reuse areas themselves, we have to go out on an individual basis and winch those up on a truck and haul them in on our own, which just simply requires more of our time and effort on our part. And if individuals would just bring it to us directly, then it would cut the overall cost down to the community.
Jordan says the weekly pickups cost the borough a few more dollars in labor, but some of that's recovered by selling such white goods for scrap metal. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. 3-2-1. For as long as there have been governments at war, soldiers have had to endure the trauma of battle. And as soon as the shooting stops, veterans begin demanding their due from national leaders who sometimes prefer to dismiss those claims. Vietnam veteran John Swan says U.S. veterans have been active ever since the American Revolution when they marched on Congress demanding back pay and land rights. Swan says those veterans set the stage for a long and continuing battle. As a counselor at the Fairbanks Vet Center, Swan sees some of the soldiers who continue wearing the scars of war. He's critical of the American government, which he says has long failed to live up to the agreements it makes to those who do our fighting. Pick any war, he says, and you'll find veterans with broken promises. Swan says many World War II vets became discouraged when told they couldn't get some service. But when soldiers started returning from Vietnam, rather than accept the situation, they turned their anger into action. They demanded services and recognition, and eventually their efforts paid off. For example, the Agent Orange Class Assistance Program. After fighting for years, veterans won money from Congress to provide social services for Vietnam veterans. In Fairbanks, the program has served some 350 vets and their families. Begun in 1991, it's entering its last year of funding. That at a time when a new crop of veterans, this time from the Persian Gulf War, are fighting a new battle. Gulf War veterans complain of skin and digestive problems and that their children are being born with defects, injuries they blame on chemicals they say they were exposed to during the war against Iraq. The government hasn't found any link between the Gulf War and the problems of these vets, but the battle for benefits continues. Swan says he's hopeful that over time, the government will take more responsibility for the soldiers it sends to war.
Services have gotten better in many, many ways. Services need to continue taking care of the veteran with a valid complaint. And it can't be as it was after the Revolutionary War, after the Civil War, after the World War I, World War II, where it took a population that was disgruntled to demand the rights for medical care or being treated with respect.
In many ways, the government has improved conditions for its soldiers. Congress is considering a bill that would allow the Vietnam Vet Centers to serve World War II, Korean, and Gulf War veterans. And during the Gulf War, military officials made sure their mission was clearly defined and achievable, so while those who died paid dearly, American losses were relatively low. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. A handful of Fairbanks High School students recently used software they found on the internet to break into the district's computer system. Software that UAF's Roger Azerby says anyone can acquire anytime.
Basically from web crawler, if you just type in the word hackers, you'll get a huge list of sites. Actually, someone here on campus has a website. He has this page here that he's set up that has a lot of these things that I was mentioning. He's got password cracking tools on this page. He's got virus creation utilities on this page. Got a lot of stuff.
Azerby is a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he works in the computer lab. He says most of the hackers he knows are just intellectually curious, not malicious. In the case of the high school hackers, only passwords in the electronic mail system were fooled with. And the school district's Nick Stayrook also downplayed the offense when he explained why they weren't going to prosecute the students who cracked their system.
Most of these are very good students in our district. I mean, they're straight A kids and things like that. It's the first time for a lot of these kids, and generally at the high school level on a first offense, we leave that to the principal's discretion. However, if we feel that these things are being repeated, we could take some very serious action, including pressing criminal charges against the students.
But at least one of the high school students has been taken to task before for hacking. He broke into the university's computer system this summer. Officials say he broke into an account giving him access to sensitive programs. The student was kicked off the system. Joe Knox, a manager of academic computing at UAF, also has a problem when the district says their compromised email was a mild case of hacking.
I don't want to say mild because although they weren't doing any damage, they did cost the school district quite a bit in terms of staff time, and once they knew they had a problem, probably their main system manager spent, I don't know, as much as 2 weeks on it full time.
Knox believes the district transferred roughly 2,000 mail accounts off of one computer onto another, then issued all new passwords in order to clear up the problem. Other computer staffers say that stronger measures should be taken against hackers to set an example. But the university's Don Foley, who directs judicial services, says in many cases, those in authority lack clear guidelines.
One of the things that the law enforcement agencies are facing, very similar to an institution of higher education, is there really aren't, and particularly in hacking types of issues, there's really not a lot of laws on the books, per se, to say this is a violation or this is illegal and this isn't.
Foley admits more people are misusing computers on campus. This semester, for example, he says he's dealt with more computer-related offenses than all of last year. For now, most observers say institutions will just have to stay one step ahead of hackers to secure their computer systems. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Computer stalkers, 3, 2, 1. Ann Salminen says she's still a little uncomfortable getting her email off of UAF's computer system. A while back, she gave a talk in a science class, and soon afterwards, she says, she started getting messages from someone she didn't know.
It was someone who had heard me speak in a class and then was curious about just who I was and if I wanted to interact with them. And because I'm married, it's not something I'm interested in, I just didn't respond. And the person was rather persistent over the next few months and sent me more messages, each time trying to ingratiate themselves and, you know, in different ways.
Salminen won't go so far as to call her experience harassment.
But she says it's made her wary, especially after she talked with other students.
I've talked to at least a couple people about it, and some that have had actual harassment where, in the end, the person got really strange and they had to cut off all ties with them.
Probably that case went before Don Foley, who's director of judicial services at UAF. He says computer-related infractions have exploded this semester. Many of them are harassment cases. He believes it's a problem on campuses across the nation. As more and more students use system computers, he says, the chances for electronic harassment also go up.
Students somehow think that harassment is not as personal if they write it and then send it via the computer versus if they were to confront someone in the middle of a hallway and say those exact same things. They understand that that would be harassment, but there's not necessarily the understanding that doing that same thing in written language over the computer still constitutes harassment.
Foley says UAF treats all harassment cases the same, and he adds most students, when they understand the consequences, stop harassing. On the other hand, some don't, and sometimes they become more aggressive. Donald Tubbs, a lab instructor in the Journalism and Broadcasting Department at UAF, says there are cyberspace stalkers.
If you know how to do it, you can actually kind of skulk around networks, like monitoring people's internet transmissions, which is why if you're going to email someone, you should assume that your email is not secure.
Tubbs says stalkers are rare. More common, however, are the mail bombers, who send million block files that essentially lock the victim out of their computer system. All of this has campus police scratching their heads. They say they have few guidelines where freedom of speech ends and felonies begin. Last year, they had the FBI ready to prosecute one student who jokingly put out a murder contract over the internet. Security officials say they're looking to pending legislation in Congress that will restrict expression on the internet to help them police an increasingly complex labyrinth of electronic activity. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. Electronic activity. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. One. The assembly heard more public testimony Thursday night for and against a library display that sparked outrage from parts of the Fairbanks community. The October display, sponsored by PFLAG, the Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gays, depicted the contributions and persecution of gays throughout history. The Library Commission held public meetings on the display, but it declined to pull the exhibit. Then assembly members Bob Logan and Larry Hackenmiller crafted an ordinance that barred all groups from using the library's display cases. Last night, Hackenmiller reiterated his belief the issue demanded assembly action.
The commission is not going to be looking at the Berry Room and the children and the families, the inherent right of families to raise their children and give them values as they see fit. They are going to be looking at First Amendment rights. And you will see, well, we're going to allow a procedure. They'll come up with procedures probably for display, which they said they didn't have to begin with. And I have no objections to this ordinance as it stands now in voting for it and making that decision. It is not for the Library Commission to dictate what this community should represent. It is for the elected officials to represent the community.
At a work session last week, Library Commission members told the Assembly they could draft the library policy to deal fairly with controversial subjects. Last night, Assembly Member Cheryl Kilgore expressed confidence in the Commission. She also said she hoped her community was mature enough to deal with controversy.
I think there's a way for us to continue to have a forum that may or may not be controversial in the library, and to have that forum and exercise that forum in a peaceful and respectful way. I can't accept the issue about public safety, because if we cannot agree to disagree peacefully, we are a society of chaos. And clearly that's unacceptable behavior. I don't think any of us would agree that that's an acceptable response.
In the end, by 6-5, the Assembly turned down the ordinance and sent the issue back to the Library Commission. The commission members have 4 months now to develop a policy that balances the public's need for a forum in which to air controversial subjects
with the desire of some parents to better insulate children from such displays. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Whether you work in a restaurant, at the university or the hospital, at a grocery store, or in the building trades, you have probably had your hand on federal dollars of one sort or another. Mark Gramstead, documentation coordinator for the Fairbanks North Star Bureau, says we tend to see the most visible sources of federal dollars, two military bases and a profusion of federal agencies, but people are less likely to think about the indirect, less visible dollars.
The sources of the money coming through Department of Transportation for federal highway grants. You have payment in lieu of taxes coming into local governments because they have the military bases within their political boundaries. Research dollars coming into UAF, Fish and Wildlife Officers, BLM. The military, of course, is a major source of income within the borough. And there are many others. Basically, we've all got a little slice of the federal pie.
The military adds direct money to the general economy, but a lot of indirect dollars, too, in no small part because military and their families make up the largest single population group here. At nearly 18,000 people, they're over 20% of the local population. Military dollars move into the civilian economy, becoming off-base groceries, clothing, movies, and cars, and military, dependent, and civilian workers all share in and are impacted by the collective job market, in big ways and in small ones. UAF political science professor Jerry McBeth.
There are a number of people who are employed on a contractual basis in the private sector. For example, I had a student come to my office who said her husband was just furloughed. He wasn't a military employee, but he did work for a contractor who supplied goods to the military.
Overall, government, local, state, and federal, provides a substantial part of our economic base.
It's about a third or so in terms of those employed. And then if you look at all of the private sector jobs that are reliant on serving those who have federal, state, or local jobs, then it adds up to well over a half.
The 10,000 local, state, and federal non-military government workers in the borough make up the largest single category of people at work. Service providers, everyone from mechanics, doctors, and engineers to hotel workers, are the next largest group. And those in retail come in third. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
For more than 20 years, Custom Woodworking has furnished Fairbanks home builders with fine kitchen cabinetry and other wood products. Last weekend, shop owner John Manthai asked customers and friends to evaluate his latest venture, Rustic Pole Furniture. Some 500 people dropped by to look at the company's selection of sofas, tables, and other furnishings, all built from fire-killed black spruce. It's a venture that Manthai hopes will expand enough to offset a declining custom cabinetry market.
It is indeed a different branch. We've always been a custom shop, which is kind of a service-oriented business. And one thing that the interior doesn't have is manufacturing. And we would like to see the Pole Furniture Project take on that capacity. We would like to produce things at a manufacturer's level and then reach the retail market.
At the urging of project foreman Les Graves, Manthai has invested more than $100,000 in the new venture, building an addition and buying more machinery. That includes about $8,000 for a tenon maker. Graves says this device allows a semi-skilled worker to cut a pole end in a fraction of the time it takes a skilled worker to do the same work on a lathe. After the tenons are cut, the poles are joined with others to build any number of items, each with its own character.
I don't like to call it rustic because I think it's a little bit better than rustic. The unique thing about it is the material, the resource, and it's Alaskan. And that's what we're selling. And along with that, we're selling the quality of our workmanship.
Graves says while lower labor costs help make the product affordable to the middle class, that doesn't guarantee the company will find success as it attempts to meet the broad challenge before it.
We're going off into a whole new arena here, marketing. You know, what's that all about? We've never done any marketing before. It's all been word of mouth. We've never even done any advertising. And so it's a new playing field here for us.
The company is getting some help. The State Division of Forestry is working out a negotiated sale to ensure a steady wood supply. Manthai is pursuing grants, and says many people and agencies are pitching in to help him turn dead trees into dollars.
A cord of black spruce delivered to our shop is about $205 worth of raw material, and that converts to $15,000 to $20,000 worth of furniture, so that is truly value added. And most of that value is labor, so that money is Fairbanks money.
Minthai says in the last months he's had to negotiate a wide array of challenges and knows there are many more to come as he attempts to transition from a high-end custom shop into the competitive world of manufacturing. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. 2-1. After spending years befriended to the bottle herself, Patty Hyslip swore off alcohol and became a strong advocate for sobriety. As director of Tanana's alcohol program, she successfully carried the message to many others, but was unable to reach her longtime partner, Melvin Edwin. Last January, alcohol claimed another list of victims when Edwin leveled a gun at Hyslip and killed her. Edwin then turned the gun on himself and, in a failed suicide attempt, destroyed much of his face. In imposing the sentence, Superior Court Judge Richard Savelle said while Edwin was not convicted of first-degree murder, there were enough aggravating circumstances to justify a longer-than-usual sentence. Those included killing Hyslip in front of two children. Hyslip's sister, Polly Jardine, says the family's satisfied with the longer sentence. She hopes now that the members of both families can begin speaking to each other.
I think there's still a lot of forgiving that needs to be done because there was a lot of pain that happened after Patty died as a result of this act of violence. And I would like to see us start talking and start healing as a community again.
The aftermath of the murder split the community of Tanana. It prompted residents to push for closure of the city liquor store and a ballot initiative to take the community dry. Voters defeated the proposal last spring. Melvin Edwin must serve at least one-third of his 50-year sentence. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
He was arrested on a number of outstanding misdemeanor warrants held by the Anchorage Police Department. He was also arrested for two warrants which the Fairbanks troopers had, one charging him with armed robbery and one charging him with felony assault.
3-2-1. It's been a long time coming, but Manfred West was finally sentenced Monday in Fairbanks Superior Court. West was charged with killing Joe Vogler in May of 1993. Court documents indicate that West shot Vogler after the two got into an argument at Vogler's home. West was sentenced to 75 years for the murder and five more for evidence tampering when he buried Vogler's body in a gravel pit outside of town. West has already been serving time for arson and forgery convictions. District Attorney Harry Davis asked for 99 years, but Judge Ralph Beislein knocked that down to 75. West's attorney Art Robson says at West's age, the difference is almost meaningless.
Fred is almost 40. He'll be 40 in a few weeks now. He is began serving last year, both whatever there would be on this case, plus a 15-year sentence, so that dealing with 75 or 80 years now, we're dealing with time long after he will be deceased.
Robson says West has told him that after spending more than half his life in jail, he's better suited to that environment than being on the outside. But while this chapter appears closed, people involved in Vogler's life say this story is by no means over. The last 2 years have spawned several conspiracy theories. One has the federal government plotting to kill Joe Vogler for his efforts at bringing the case for Alaskan independence to the United Nations. Another blames the death on jealous members within the Alaskan Independence Party. Lately, accusers say conspirators wanted a piece of Vogler's sizable estate, namely gold, he was rumored to have. Longtime Vogler friend Al Rowe says by foregoing a trial, this story may outlive anyone involved.
There's just too many unanswered questions out there, rumors, too many accusations, innuendos. Joe was a controversial figure. It's just too much. To believe that this one fellow has done this awful deed. I still think there's a conspiracy behind it, but we'll never know unless he gets to trial.
Rowe, a former state trooper, says he has dozens of questions regarding the trooper's investigation into the killing.
There's $2 million in gold nuggets missing, so where's this gold at? What's it used for? Was it to Was it used to, bar witnesses? Was it used to cover this whole thing up or what?
Rose says his investigation leads him to believe there were several other people involved in the murder. On these points, others agree, including Independence Party member Lynette Clark.
There's way too many holes. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered. Hopefully, with the fact now that the case is closed, as far as the police say, you know, they got their killer. They have their statistics under their belts. But we're going to be able to get our hands on a lot more information than we had before and fill in some of the holes of what we think needs to be looked at and pursue that.
Clark says she plans to push forward with some Freedom of Information Act requests, which she hopes will lead to a special investigation. In the meantime, West remains in jail. His attorney plans to meet with him on Tuesday regarding possible appeals. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
I have talked to him. He has come to the conclusion that because he has spent more than half of his life, since he was 16 anyway, in jails of various sort, that he's institutionalized, and he feels more comfortable inside than he does out.
Fred's got a long time behind bars to have him play the game out as far as his appeal processes go. I guess this is part of what you would call justice. The other side of the coin, in my opinion, is that one day he's going to meet up with Mrs. Vogler. And anybody that knew Doris will smile at what I've just said.
A recent report by the FBI says violent crimes changing in America. More murders committed by strangers against strangers. More young people committing murders. Alaska's slower to change, but it's following the trend. Susan McGinnis reports on murder in the far north.
A clerk in a convenience store at 3 in the morning. Another clerk in a liquor store. A man walking on a downtown street. A young woman who stepped outside for a cigarette. In the past few years, murders by strangers have just about tripled in Alaska. And murder committed by juveniles has nearly doubled. It is a different kind of violent crime than we are used to, harder to understand. The FBI says things are changing nationwide. Here, too, Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Jim McCann.
You know, when I first started in this business almost 24 years ago, you know, we had some old guard type criminals that we looked at all the time. Those people are long gone now. Anymore, we have a growing number of crimes committed by young people with guns just for the thrill of it.
McCann says much of the violent crime committed by young people involves firearms. There are simply a lot of guns around, he says, and a perplexing, colder attitude.
The youth seem to be hardened, guns, violence, there's a lot of bad talk. That's the way I sum it up. They talk bad, they try and act bad, and eventually they commit these crimes with no remorse. Very scary.
District Attorney Harry Davis agrees.
The young offender is getting far more sophisticated in the crimes they're committing, far more violent. There's hardcore. And I didn't see that 10 years ago. And the kinds of youthful offenders we have now are pretty scary individuals.
Crimes by strangers against strangers are harder to solve. When people who know each other kill, whether in rage or vengeance or for some other reason, there are trails of evidence in the relationship. But if the only point of contact between murderer and victim is the murder, and if there are no witnesses, investigators must rely heavily on forensic evidence and informants. Investigator Jim McCann.
Generally, the only thing that gets these people caught is their own mouths, or their ignorance, and they're not always that smart, and they make a mistake or two. But if there's no connection to the victim, if they're just thrill-seeking crimes. Real difficult. No trail. The evidence doesn't mean anything until you know who it is, until you catch them. Tough cases.
Harry Davis has been district attorney for the Interior's 4th Judicial District for 24 years. He says the changing face of murder changes the number of cases his office can bring to court.
The conviction rate hasn't changed. The problem with these cases is the rate of solving them is a lower percentage than you would have and the other type of murderers. Those are the most difficult types of murders to solve.
Nationwide, violent crime is not increasing. It is decreasing. And in the last few years, Alaska has followed that trend, too, although murder is up in Anchorage this year. Perhaps it is the change in violent crime that has people so persistently anxious. We have always feared the stranger most, and violence coming out of the blue. Jim McCann says times are changing. People must begin to look after themselves and their neighbors better, and to pay attention to what's going on around them.
Now, we at the troopers are getting cut back constantly. We have less and less troopers now than I think we ever have, in my opinion. So people are pretty much on their own. They have to be aware of what's going on around them and react to it.
In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
The latest FBI crime report says the nature of murders changing. Fewer murders overall, but more by strangers and young people. Alaska's following the trend, but in the interior, one kind of murder has remained persistently high for decades. Susan McInnes has this report on sexual homicide.
Women have always had to be more careful. We are vulnerable in ways that men are not, and more at risk for violence. In interior Alaska, it is especially true. Fairbanks almost always leads the nation in per capita sexual assaults, and we have high rates of both serial rape and sexual homicide. Trooper Sergeant Jim McCann says the Fairbanks murder of Sophie Sergey in 1993 is a case in point.
I mean, that's not a victim-precipitated crime. I mean, she was killed because she was a woman, and not because she did anything wrong. It's not because of drug connections or passions of any kind. Sophie Sergey was killed because she was a woman, just like so many others. Brenda Keir, Kara Zastrow, and we could go down a list. Kathy Stockholm, we could go down a list way too long.
The list of reasons is also long. We are a young and mostly immigrant population, separated from our extended families. District Attorney Harry Davis says it also has something to do with the higher ratio of men to women and the military presence. And, he says, it is where we are.
Something to do with the fact that we're sort of at the end of the road, that we get a lot of people who are running away from things in the lower 48, and they come up here, and those kind of people sometimes get themselves in trouble. And so it all adds up, and then you throw in the environmental problems in the winter, it's going to add up to a high crime rate and a high rate of crime committed regarding sexual assaults.
Those reasons notwithstanding, McCann says the men who commit sexual homicides are something else again. They are harder to catch, harder to see.
They don't go around and brag about what they do. They're like chameleons, too. They fit into the community, and you just don't know what evil goes on behind their eyes. Those cases will always be extremely difficult to solve.
Sophie Sergey's murder goes unsolved. McCann says there are very few leads and no telling where the man who killed her is.
It could be that he's gone to another area. It could be that he's incarcerated. It could be that he died. Or it could be none of those. He could be still here in our community and just laying low. Generally, within a year after their first crime, a year or less, such a sexual murderer will hit again. But sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes there's a two-year span. There's still a lot we don't know about these kind of people.
After more than 20 years of service, Jim McCann remains frustrated. It is not just that these crimes keep happening or that they are difficult to bring to justice. In recent years, the trouble is also the number of troopers available to track them.
When I started in this same unit in 1972, there were 9 investigators. I have 4 now, including myself. And that's up from 93 and 94, where there were only 3 of us. So, with all the crimes coming in every day, it's kind of hard to get to the cases like Sophie Sergey and other unsolved murders that we have. Real hard.
The murders of Brenda Keir, Kara Zastrow, and Kathy Stockholm have all been resolved and their killers jailed. The murder of Sophie Sergey remains the only unsolved sexual homicide in the interior. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Our series on the changing face of crime concludes today with an exploration of how crime by young people, especially boys and young men, is also changing, and in some disturbing ways. Susan McInnes reports.
Not long ago, a Fairbanks couple and their 8-month-old child were at home when two young men, armed with a 9mm automatic, burst through their door. Trooper Sergeant Jim McCann took the call.
And they robbed them. I happen to know one of the two young people that was arrested for that crime, and I knew him when he was, I think, 9, 10 years old. I never expected to be around and to see long enough and to see Fairbanks become that way, that young people would take up guns and do those sorts of crimes, I guess. But it's happening. I mean, horrific crimes. And to be in your home and to have a door burst open and someone come in with a pistol, I don't think it can get much worse than that.
But break-ins are not unusual, nor is armed robbery, nor vandalism, nor violence. This year, a young man was executed in a grocery store parking lot. Two other young men went out looking for someone to kill one night, and they murdered a man. In the news lately, reports of women threatened and assaulted. A lone man robbed at gunpoint in his home. A teenager rousted and robbed on the street. All by young people. District Attorney Harry Davis says there is something wrong in the society, and he says break-ins, violence, even murder by young people in a community like ours are collectively the early signs of something worse to come.
So we can lock some of these dangerous offenders up, but there will be more and more be reduced by whatever is causing this in our society. I mean, we can debate whether or not it's indifference to violence on television or the breakup of the family home. I mean, but whatever it is, we're beginning to pay the price for it now.
Davis says he tries to explain to victims or to their families how someone could rob or murder or rape. He says they can't understand it.
What you have to understand, these people don't think like you do. They don't have any feelings which basically tell this is right or wrong. They don't have any feelings when they do something terrible to people. It's just like stepping on an ant, and that's what you're dealing with. And so most average people don't understand that. But that's the kind of people we got out there. And they don't think anything about putting a gun to somebody's head and pulling the trigger.
In the last 8 years, Sam Morton has run the Presbyterian Hospitality House in Fairbanks, 3 long-term group homes for emotionally troubled and delinquent young people.
One of the things that I see that's going on here is that we have a too high of tolerance for out-of-control behavior, for posturing delinquent behavior. And it leads to the kind of crimes that we see that are taking place with kids committing crimes against kids, kids committing crimes against adults.
Morton says he sees a lost generation of kids these days, kids who don't feel they belong anywhere, kids who want recognition, who want to belong, but only know how to get what they want by what he calls negative attention seeking.
Well, negative attention seeking in years ago was maybe stealing a candy bar, or maybe sassing someone or talking back. Negative attention seeking has moved into another realm, has moved into, watch me, I can make the news. Watch me, I can make TV. Watch me, I'm bad. So what we have is a generation of kids who watch television, who wants to be a part of television, that has a separate reality from what we grew up with.
Sam Morton says delinquent kids need to be taken in hand, to be made accountable for their actions, to be taught how to live all over again. And District Attorney Harry Davis calls on parents and people living in community with each other to do a great deal to change things for young people and for the future of the community.
The question is whether society is willing to pay the price, whether society is willing to take on the problems. It's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be easy to turn things around. It just starts with at the home. I mean, trying to control your old children, it's easy to say you're going to do it, but, I'm a parent myself. It's a lot easier, harder to implement the things you know that needs to be done. It's going to take people being concerned. It's going to take people being active and trying to get legislation changes. It's going to take pressure upon the things which are being done by corporate America pertaining to exploitation of the youth. It's going to be take a societal effort to change these things, and it's not going to be easy. But I don't think we have much alternative, or we're going to live in a community none of us want to live in because we're not going to be safe to live in it.
The Governor's Conference on Youth and Justice held last week in Anchorage will be followed by 10 months of study on some of these questions. The next step will be the rewriting of the state's juvenile laws. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. Last year, the Marine Mammal Protection Act was amended to require an accurate accounting of every marine mammal in the United States. In Alaska, the stipulation triggered questions about the way harbor seals are counted and what those counts might mean. At stake is more than just a number. The federal government will use such assessments to set bycatch limits for commercial fishermen and could use them to limit subsistence harvests. This week, federal and state researchers were working on ways to create an accurate count. Carl Hild is a marine mammal biologist and planner for RuralCap. He says counting harbor seals is no simple task.
Real difficult proposition where you have a lot of airplanes with a lot of people in them trying to spot very small animals as they're flying along the coast. And a lot of times these animals are not all hauled out at the same time. So you have to have some kind of correction factor to figure out, okay, if you see 100 animals on a rocky haul out, how many are actually there? There may be another 100 in the water.
The researchers are also examining trends and ways to get consistent data over time. Such factors as surveying the same site at the same time of year, even at the same time of day, wherever and whenever they'll have the best opportunity for their counts. Carl Hild.
Likewise, it depends on where the tide is, whether it's about to reach low tide or if the tide's coming back in. That has a significant impact. Depends on the time of year, whether the animals are molting, whether they've are there during pupping time period. And so all these factors have to be considered so that when you go back, you have the least variation in your numbers, because the trend, you want to have as close as possible so you can reproduce that every year.
Hild says to evaluate trends, researchers need at least 5 years worth of annual surveys, each requiring from 5 to 10 flights over an area. Among trends they're now examining, an increase in the southeast harbor seal population, a decline in the Gulf of Alaska population, and stability of harbor seals in Bristol Bay. Representatives of the National Marine Fisheries Service and the newly formed Alaska Native Harbor Seal Commission were also at this week's meetings. They have been discussing formal co-management agreements for harbor seal harvest and protection. Again, Carl Hild.
The intent being that with more native involvement and oversight in regards to their harvest, that these animals won't decline, that local knowledge will be used to assist scientific researchers to gain greater understanding, and that perhaps some solutions can come up before these animals go through other more formal federal processes of being listed as depleted, threatened, or finally endangered.
A second group, the Bristol Bay Harbor Seal Council, is likely to join in the coming co-management agreements. Harbor Seal Commission Executive Director Monica Rydell says it is encouraging that the native community is being included in both research and in harbor seal management. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
A large series of benefit programs. And then
for 840 Aleut people, the move was sudden and life-changing. Today, 65-year-old Anatoly Lekhanov tells how it happened. He was just 11 years old then.
As kids playing out, we saw two men walking over the horizon from the other side, from the south side of St. George Island, two men coming to the village. And right away the kids ran around yelling and said, "Two men are coming to the village."
They were not the enemy, not the Japanese attacking. The two American Navy men came to tell the people of St. George they had just 12 hours to evacuate their homes. "Pack one suitcase," they said, "and bring the bedding, but nothing more. Not tools to assure their livelihood, not their religious or personal possessions." The Lekhanovs and their friends and neighbors were taken by boat from St. George and others from St. Paul, all to Funter Bay on Admiralty Island. A baby was born on board the ship, but died en route. Anatoly's sister took ill then, too. She had double pneumonia before they landed and died while the family was interned at Funter Bay. So did both of Anatoly's grandmothers. He says the abandoned cannery where they stayed for 2 years was cold, damp, and drafty.
These were abandoned shut down, not kept up buildings. You could see the sky and the stars looking at the ceiling. You could see through some cracks the stars up there in the sky at nighttime. The caretaker was mad. He says, I wished I would have been notified ahead of time. I would have said not fit for any human being to be brought there, to be laid there for 2 years.
Years later, as an adult, Anatoly Lekhanov returned to Funter Bay.
The conditions I saw were just terrible. It's a wonder they didn't fall. The building didn't fall while we were there. In 78, they were just like a whale hunter in Barrow after taking meat off of the animal, and the remains become just bone, skeleton. These buildings were like that in 78. It was just like a nightmare.
After 2 years in the camps in 1945, the war over and danger passed, the Aleut people were returned home. The military had occupied St. George in their absence. The linoleum in the Lekhanov home was worn through, and they found spikes in their walls that had held weapons. A cedar chest of embroidered linens was gone, and ivory carvings and other craft work. But perhaps worse, the island's livestock and all the reindeer were dead. Years later, a grant-funded project began reindeer recovery on St. George. Today, the herd is mostly back. But what Anatoly Lekhanov calls the replanting was neither certain nor easy on the first reindeer. It reminds him, he says, of what happened to the people.
Some of those 15 animals had died because of, in the hull of the ship. Like even human beings died in Funter Bay because of discomforting them, and lifestyle is thinking they'll never go back to living in the island in a village again. Some of the old timers died of a broken heart. So these reindeer, some of them died like that, see, a broken heart in the dark, the hull of the ship. What's happening to me? I might as well give up. And some of them died. But those that stayed alive today is multiplying almost back up to that same number again.
When he lived at Funter Bay, Anatoly Lekhanov was just a boy. He says he didn't know then what his parents endured.
To us, we were enjoying being togetherness, many villages together. And we have not just one priest, but we have two priests, you know. For children, 11-year-old kid, it's a gaze of time, you know, just fun time.
Today, when he speaks about the internment, Lekhanov says he can feel what they felt.
But how the parents, too bad they're not living to be asked. But I could almost feel their age now, because I'm there, the age-wise, and every lecture, tears come to my eyes. How parents must have felt.
Anatoly Lekhanov has been in Fairbanks to view the University Museum exhibit called Forced to Leave on the evacuation and internment of Aleut and Japanese Americans. He lectured last night at Norwegian Library. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.